Underworld, Disc 9.
Weeks later, Edgar picked up a copy of Time on her way out of the refectory, and there she saw it. A large color photo of a white-haired woman seated in a director's chair beneath the old weathered wing of an Air Force bomber. And she recognized the name, Clara Sachs, because she recognized everything, because people whispered names to her, because she felt stirrings of information in the dusty corridors of the convent or the school supply room that smelled of pencil wood and composition books, because she sensed some dark knowledge floating in the smoke of the priest's swinging censer, because things were defined for her by the creak of old floorboards and the odor of clothes, a man's damp camel coat, because she drew news and rumors and catastrophes into the spotless cotton pores of her habit and veil. All the connections intact. The woman once married to a local man, the man a tutor in chess to one of Edgar's own former students, the boy with necktie ever askew, Matthew Aloysius Shea, fingernails bitten to the pink, one of her brainier boys, male parent missing. She knew things, yes. Chess. All those layers of Slavic stealth, those ensnarements and ploys. She knew that Bobby Fischer had all the fillings removed from his teeth when he played Boris Spassky in 1972. It made perfect sense to her. So the KGB could not control him through broadcasts made into the amalgam units packed in his molars. She put the magazine in her closet with the old fan mags she'd stopped reading decades ago when she lost her faith in movie stars. The faith of suspicion and unreality. The faith that replaces God with radioactivity. The power of alpha particles and the all-knowing systems that shape them. The endless fitted links. That night she leaned over the wash basin in her room and cleaned a steel wool pad with disinfectant. Then she used the pad to scour a scrub brush, cleaning every bristle. But she hadn't cleaned the original disinfectant in something stronger than disinfectant. She hadn't done this because the regression was infinite. And the regression was infinite because it is called infinite regression. You see how fear spreads beyond the pushy extrusions of matter and into the elevated spaces where words play upon themselves. She cleaned and she prayed. She said brief prayers while she worked, simple pious pleas called ejaculations that carried indulgences numbered in the days rather than years. She prayed and she thought. She went to bed and lay awake and thought of Esmeralda. They'd spotted her a number of times but hadn't been able to catch her. Not Gracie or the monks or the agile writers in Ismail's crew. And Edgar's sense of her safety was beginning to grow less assured. She welcomed every breath of knowledge that came her way, all the better for its element of disquiet. But this time the foreboding shook her strongly. She sensed something out there in the wall. A muddled, shuffling danger that waited for the girl on her lithe passage through car bodies and discarded human limbs and acres of uncollected garbage. Mother of Mercy, pray for us. 300 days. Chapter 9. Nick was trying to find the magazine he'd been saving to take to Houston. He saved certain kinds of reading for business trips, things he never got around to looking at otherwise, magazines that stacked and nagged and finally went to the sidewalk on the designated day. There was a noise that started, a world hum. You began to hear it when you left your carpeted house and rode out to the airport. He wanted something friendly to read in the single, sustained drone that marks every mile in a business traveler's day. The magazine was Time, missing about a month. He found it finally in the bathroom, stashed in a basket that Marion kept filled with mostly glossy fashion books. Every shadow brushed to an anatomical polish, contoured against crumble and waste. Just the thing to browse when your body is squatted and your pants are down. The copy of Time had an article on Clara Sachs he wanted to read. Not the first such piece he'd spotted through the years, but maybe more interesting than most, some desert project she'd started, bristling with ambition. His suitcase was on the bed, small enough for the overhead bin, and he zippered the magazine into an outer pocket and finished packing. Marion walked in wearing her Catwoman shades. They came with a job. She worked for the city's Arts Commission now, and wanted a sleeker look. "Don't you need to hurry?" "The car's not here. I trust the car," he said.
"The car is dependable.
The car knows things we don't know.
The car is never late.
The car and the plane are in constant touch." She always looked great when he was walking out the door. Why is that, he thought. Some soft-bodied mood. Some tone that half insisted on being noticed, but was also a shy secret, afraid of disturbing the air between them. He moved her into the wall and put his hands on her thighs, kiss-biting her mouth and neck. She said something he didn't quite catch. He put his hands between her ass and the wall and moved her into him. Her skirt slid against her parted legs, fabric stretched out and up, the tensile whisper of friction he counted on to carry him through life. He stepped back slightly and looked at her. "Why is that?" he said.
"What are we talking about?"
"And why is it that when I get back, the whole thing's gone and lost and forgotten?"
"What thing?"
He took off her sunglasses and handed them to her. When he walked out the door, seconds later, the company car was waiting. A few hours later, Marion stood in a small room in a two-story pale brick building near Jack in the Box and Braco. Cars were parked under a lopsided shed out back, and there was a man's abandoned shoe in one of the empty slots. She stood naked in the room by the edge of the window. Then she walked to the long mirror and edged her hip against the surface of the glass, feeling some small coiled chill of body and object. She looked all right. All the exercise, the diet, the exercise, all the butt repetition, the toilsome boredom she endured in the name of keeping fit. She was not the twisted, perfect woman she used to be, but she still kept fit. Fuck you, keep fit. She stood squared up to the glass. Nothing she could do about the needle nose, but otherwise not bad. She never looked at herself so closely at home. It was easier to see herself out here, inside strange walls. She let her nipples touch the glass, and when she backed away, she saw they'd left a moistness, a pair of pressed kisses like winter breath. When Brian arrived, she was wearing a robe she'd found in the closet.
"I shouldn't be here," he said. "Neither should I. This is the point, isn't it?"
He sat on the edge of the bed, taking off his shoes, a little like the class crybaby undressing for gym. "Whose place is this?"
"My assistant's."
"Are you serious?"
"Why not? We need a safe place," she said.
"But your secretary?"
"My assistant. And it's better than a hotel."
"I shouldn't be here." He walked around the room barefoot, unbuttoning his shirt. He had clown feet, long and bunioned, and he didn't loosen his tie until he'd pulled his shirt out of his trousers. "Is she young?"
"How do you know it's a woman?"
"Seriously, young?"
"Yes," she said.
He walked around touching things, looking at photographs and matchbooks. "Good looking?"
"You want to check out her underwear? Look, I'm wearing a robe. Fuck me, fuck me, fuck me," she said dryly.
"She can't afford better?"
We're under-budgeted. It's a roomette. Small but intense, Marion said. She was standing against the wall, arms folded, and he stepped into her. She freed her hands and worked at his pants. She liked having sex with Brian because she could handle him, turn him, get him to match her mood, rouse him easily, or make him talk. Talk. Acid, candid, shameful stuff. Bitter funny. I think he knows, she said.
What?
I think he knows.
He doesn't know.
I think he knows. She had her hands in his pants and a smile on her face. He moved the robe off half her body, smeared it, rubbed it against her shoulder and breast before he got it off her, almost off her, pulling her arm through the hole and letting the garment drag. They eased onto the bed. She tried to get clear of the rest of the robe, but he wouldn't let her. He wanted a woman in half a robe. The phone rang, and they stopped to listen. Every time a phone rang in a borrowed apartment, they stopped and thought about the thing they were doing, and maybe at some level about the life of the person whose apartment they were using. It made them feel the wrong kind of guilty trespass, she thought. The bed, the mystery of the other person's life and medicine cabinet and bed. It was the one thing she didn't like about this, one among others, and she couldn't have sex to a ringing phone. She felt around for her handbag, which was on a chair at the side of the bed. The ringing stopped. Brian got off the bed and finished undressing.
You trust her to keep quiet?
She keeps quiet about everything else.
This isn't everything else.
Marion found her cigarettes and lit one up, and he handed her an ashtray.
I thought you stopped.
I'm down to 5 a day.
I thought you were wearing the patch.
I'm not, she said. He stretched out next to her, on his side. The ringing phone had brought them prematurely to a lazy state of small caresses and mellow bends of conversation and streams of smoke. He said,
This job of yours, real or fake?
I work with structural engineers, urban designers. I fight with citizens groups all the time. But I get things done, pretty much.
I had lunch in a mechanical mist the other day, in some mall somewhere.
We don't do malls. We do parkways.
What do you do to a parkway?
Make it livable, bearable. Tell little stories. Sculpture on the road dividers. Piers that are shaped like animals.
What's your secretary's name? He said.
She tipped a length of ash onto his pubic hair.
Long hours, single-minded devotion. Stuck in that Japanese thing, he said. Death from overwork.
Disappear in the company and die. Only I don't do it to disappear. I do it to be visible and audible. And I'm not sure what you mean by real or fake.
He picked the ashes out of his crotch and blew them off the tips of his fingers. Most jobs are fake, he said. They'd been late starters and had never developed a reliable pace. Only 3 or 4 apartments in all this time, and they'd used each apartment only once or twice. She'd learned not to notice her disappointment. This was an aspect of being twistedly perfect. But Brian's reluctance was fairly maddening. She had to arrange the apartments, make the assurances, calibrate the timing, and then wonder if he'd show. They talk about demon lovers. She had a demon husband. Her lover was a loose-jointed guy with a freckled forehead and nappy hair. But this was the dare she had to take, a way into some essential streak of self, some possibility that felt otherwise sandy and scanted and unturned. These times were hers, however brief and infrequent. And he was enormously easy to be with, and growing dear to her. She liked to tease and scare him, but didn't want to think about giving him up.
"Blow smoke my way," he said. "I want all the aromas.
Tobacco, bedsheets, women. She was herself with Brian, whatever that meant. She knew what it meant. Less enveloped in someone else's figuration, his self-conscious shaping of a life. "And don't let me forget, I have a meeting at 3, he said. "I'm a little put off by the fact that you haven't, you know," sort of dangling the words, "fallen in love with me, Brian." "You're my age. You're my height. I fall in love with small, brisk women I see from a distance. And they have to be young. They have to be young. You and I, we're buddies. And I'm too guilty to fall in love with you. I am very guilty. I'm guilty as shit." "Then why are you doing it?" "Because you want it so much," he said. She bent the cigarette into the ashtray. "And you're that accommodating? Because I want it? You're willing to do it?" "I want it, too. But you want it like life and death." She didn't like him when he was serious. It was outside the rules. He let his head flop toward her, whispering, "It's stupid, and it's reckless, and we shouldn't do it anymore. Because if he finds out," he whispered, "what if your wife finds out? She's the one who'll cut your balls off." "Nick will only kill me." "And he doesn't have to find out. He already knows." "He doesn't know." "I think he knows," he whispered. "Let's make this one last happy farewell fuck." She started to tell him something, but then thought, no. They fell together, folded toward each other. And then she leaned back, arching, shored on her back-braced arms, and she let him pace the occasion. At some point she opened her eyes and saw him watching her, measuring her progress. And he looked a little isolated and wan. And she pulled his head down to her and sucked the salt from his tongue, and heard the soft breast slap, the splash of upper bodies, and the banging bed. Then it was a matter of close concentration. She listened for something inside the blood rush, and she spun his hips and felt electric and desperate, and finally home free. And she looked at his eyes stung shut, and his mouth stretched so tight it seemed taped at the corners, upper lip pressed white against his teeth. And she felt a kind of hanged man's coming when he came, the jumped body and stiffened limbs. And she ran a hand through his hair. "Be nicer if we did it more often." She waited for their breathing to settle so she could ease free and get her handbag off the chair. He went to the kitchen and drank a glass of water. It was a fairly large bag, a drawstring bag, and she pulled out a length of aluminum foil and unrolled it and spread it on the bed. Brian stood watching from the kitchen entrance. Then she took out a small transparent packet. It looked like a pleated sandwich bag, only smaller, and it carried a stick-on label reading, "Death Trip Number 1. "Come here," she said. She opened the packet and let the contents, half the contents, spill onto the aluminum sheet. It was a resinous substance, chunked up, nubbed up. She told Brian to sit on the bed and pick up the sheet and hold it straight. Hold it by the edges so the stuff, the tar-like chunks, didn't run off the ends. "What the hell is it? How can it run off if it's solid?" Then she went into the handbag again and took a small, rolled-up straw of some kind, a foil straw a few inches long. "Yo, Marion, what are we doing here?" Then she reached for her matches and lit one and held it under the aluminum sheet in Brian's hands, heating the substance on the sheet. "It's heroin," she said, watching the tar slowly begin to liquefy. "It's heroin," he said. "What am I supposed to say to that?" When the tar started evaporating and smoking up, she shook out the match and put the foil straw in her mouth and trailed the curling smoke, sucking it up and holding it in her lungs conscientiously. "Okay, where'd you get it?" She watched the tar melt and run and evaporate, and she followed the smoke off the stretched foil and sucked it through the straw.
Mary Catherine?
Who's that?
My assistant.
Whose bed we're on? Your secretary's, your dealer? When did you start doing this?
I never actually thought of her.
She trailed the smoke off the sheet and put her head right into it and sucked it through the straw.
I never thought of her as my dealer. But I guess she's my dealer and I'm her whatever.
This is something new?
Fairly new, yes. Here, take a chase.
No, thanks. She trailed the smoke into the air.
I'm, you know, completely prudent. I use it rare, rare, rare. I don't get out of bed puffy-eyed or pain or nausea. Take a chase.
She sucked up the smoke.
Nick knows this?
He can't know this.
Are you crazy? He'd kill me. Take a chase.
Get the hell away from me.
I want to get you in deeper. Take a chase. I want to get you in so deep you'll stop eating and sleeping. You'll lie in bed thinking about us, doing our things in a borrowed room. You'll be able to think about nothing else. That's my program for you, Brian.
Mary Catherine. I like the name, he said. Sexy. They sat on the bed, side by side, listening to traffic roll by on Thomas Road. When she was finished, they cleared the things away and brushed off the bed and lay back talking.
I think he knows, she said.
Where is he?
On his way to Houston, or there already.
Then he drives out to that nuclear waste site, wherever it is exactly. The Salt Dome. At the mercy of the Texas Highway Killer.
He doesn't know, Brian said. But we ought to think about ending it.
We ought to make this the end.
I'm not nearly ready, so just keep quiet.
You're making me feel like some old dowd barely hanging on. You're not a dowd, you're a bawd.
Be nice to me, she said.
The day had slipped down to a drowsy pulse located somewhere near her eyes. When she stretched, she felt the jismic crust in her pubic hair speck out and crackle slightly. He whispered, "Let's have a civilized final fuck and get out alive." She listened to the traffic and wondered what she would say in the movie version. He whispered, "Let's fuck the sayonara fuck and get into our suits and dresses." She smiled faintly. The air had the feel of some auspicious design. She was feeling faintly L.A.-ish, and she rolled over on Brian and talked while they were doing it, on and off, sweetness, dearness, blowing the words, sensing an unseen design of completely auspicious things. When they were side by side, he raised up on an elbow and looked at her. "You have that molten ball of defiance in your eye."
"Just don't talk about ending. It's not yours to end."
He laughed. When Brian laughed, he became semi-transparent. You could see blood racing under his skin, a freshet of rose pink. He got up and began to dress. He picked up a fashion magazine and held it open to a looming photo of some casually muscled bisexual. Maybe a white guy, maybe not. Dangled it over the bed as if to indicate how dated he was in his own body, his very life, Brian himself, a man without a fitness video to sling in the oblong groove. "Underwear. Everything suddenly is underwear," he said. "Tell me what it means." He checked the time and got a little panicky. She attempted to help, handing items of apparel across the bed, and he fumbled things intentionally. He wore a sock inside out and tied his shoes together so he could scuttle and lurch to the door. The later it got, the more he capered. It was Brian at his best.
"But what if he knows?"
"He doesn't know," she said. She had a demon husband, if demon means a force of some kind. an attendant spirit of discipline and self-command. The little flick of distance he'd perfected, like turning off a radio. She knew about his father's disappearance, but there was something else, hard and apart. This is what had drawn her in the first place, the risky and erotic proposition. Brian was looking at the photographs on the wall by the door. Which one is her? Get out, she said. She made the bed and bagged the dope and put the robe back in the closet. She washed the glass Brian had used, standing naked in the kitchenette. And it seemed completely reasonable and natural, all of it. Earned, needed, naked. And she took a shower and got dressed. She was feeling pretty good. She felt lazy-daisy, you know. You know the way something's been nagging and dragging, and then it gets unexpectedly sort of settled. She felt all the good things would find her, which they usually don't. She would know them when she saw them with her L.A.-type eyes. She stood before the mirror, adjusting her sunglasses. Because if she didn't have this thing to do, to plan and maneuver and look forward to, this far too infrequent Brian, and this is what she almost told him earlier, she would become lonely and shaky, driving along the decorated highway under the burning sky, and maybe a little indistinct. She felt well-liked. She liked who she was today. She felt a little lazy-souled. She thought anything L.A. seemed right today. She'd even say she was more or less euphoric, although she wasn't ready to commit to that completely. Before she left, she inspected the room one last time. These were the things that opened the world to secret arrangements. The borrowed flat and memorized phone number and coded notation on the calendar. Childish spy games, really, that made her feel guiltier than the sex did. A sheepish kind of self-reproach. She patted down a pillow to remove the indentation. She wanted things to have an untouched look, so Mary Catherine would not mind when she asked to use the place again. Chapter 10. He spread the mayonnaise. He spread mayonnaise on the bread. Then he slapped the lunch meat down. He never spread the mayonnaise on the meat. He spread it on the bread. Then he slapped down the meat and watched the mayo seep around the edges. He took the sandwich into the next room. His dad was watching TV, sitting in that periscope stoop of his, crook back, like he might tumble into the rug. His dad had infirmities still waiting for a name. Things you had to play, one against another. If one thing required a certain medication, it made another thing worse. There were setbacks and side effects. There was a schedule of medications that Richard and his mother tried to keep track of through the daily twists of half doses and warning labels, and depending on this, and don't forget that. Richard ate about half the sandwich and left the rest on the arm of the chair. In the kitchen, he called his friend Bud Walling, who lived 40 miles into nowhere and wasn't really his friend. He drove out to Bud's place through old fields marked off for development, with skivvy strips on narrow posts running stiff in the wind. Out here, the wind was a force that seized the mind. You left the high school a quarter of a mile behind, still hearing the big flag snapping and the halyard beating nautically on the pole. And you powered your car into the wind and saw dust sweep across the road, and you drove into a white sky, feeling useless and dumb. Bud's place could have been something blown in from the hills. It had a look of being deposited in a natural spree, with lumber warping in the yard and sprung open doors and an unfinished porch on cinder blocks. One of those so low porches the house looked sunk in sand. Bud had a cow dog that lived in chains in a ramshackle hut out back, part coyote, part alley mutt. Richard thought this dog was less dangerous than legend would have it. Richard thought Bud kept this dog basically for the juvenile thrill of having a chained beast that he could feed or starve according to his whim. He realized he'd forgotten to give his dad 2 glasses of water to take with the blue and yellow capsule, despite the bold-faced reminder on the prescription bottle. These little failures ate away at his confidence, even when he knew it was his father's fault for not managing his own intake, or his mother's for not being around when she was needed. There were constant little wars of, whose fault is it, and, okay, I'm sorry, and I wish he'd die and get it over with, all taking place in Richard's inner mind. He did the dumb joke thing of knocking on Bud's door and saying, "Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms?" Nothing happened. He went in and saw Bud in a large open room sawing a 2x4 that he'd set between benches of unmatching height. The house was still mainly framework, although Bud had been working for many months in a conscientious struggle that Richard thought had less to do with gutting and reshaping a house than destroying some dread specter, maybe Bud's old drug habit, once and for all.
"Your phone's out of order," Richard said. "I thought I'd drive on out, see if everything, you know, is okay."
"Why wouldn't it be okay?"
"I reported it to the phone company."
"My only feeling about the phone..."
"Sometimes they correct the problem from the office."
"It brings more grief than joy."
Bud finally looked up and noted his visual presence.
"It brings personal voices into your life that you're not prepared to deal with."
Richard kept to the edges of the room, running his palms over the plain sills, examining the staples that kept plastic sheeting fastened to the window frames. It was empty distraction of the type that forestalls the pain of ordinary talk.
"I'm putting in parquet," Bud said. "Herringbone, maybe."
"Should be good."
"Better be good. But I probably won't ever do it."
The sound of the wind and the plastic sheeting was hard on the nerves. Richard wondered how an ex-addict could work all day in the scratching and popping. The sheeting popped out, it whipped and scratched. Crack cocaine fools the brain into thinking dope is good for it. He thought of something he could say.
"I tell you, Bud, I'm 42 years old next week. Week from Thursday."
"It happens."
"And I still feel like I'm half that, pretty much."
"That's because it's obvious why, you living as you do."
"What do you mean?"
"With your folks," Bud said.
"They can't manage alone."
"Who can? My question to you is..."
Bud tossed half the length of sawed wood into a corner. He studied the other half as if someone had just handed it to him on a crowded street.
"What?"
Richard said.
"Don't they smell?"
"What?"
"Old people. Like bad milk."
Richard heard the plastic windows pop.
"Not so I notice."
"Not so you notice. Okay. You want to feel your correct age? Get yourself a wife. That'll do it for you. It's horrible, but true. A wife is the only thing that saves guys like us. But they don't make you feel any younger."
Richard fidgeted happily in his corner. He liked the idea of being included in the female salvation of wayward men.
"Where is she?"
he said.
"Working the late shift now."
Bud's wife worked on the line at Texas Instruments, mounting microchips on circuit boards, Bud said, for the information highway. Richard thought he was half in love with Bud's wife. It was a feeling that came and went, secret and sort of semi-pathetic. Like his heart was made of some cotton product. If Etna ever had a clue to what he felt, what would she think? The fear this question carried made him experience actual physical symptoms, a heat, a flush across his upper back, and a tightening at the throat. He thought of something else to say.
"Left-handers. I read this the other day."
And he paused here, trying to recall the formal sentences in the narrow column of type.
"Left-handers, which I am not one of, live typically shorter lives than right-handers. Right-handed men live 10 years longer than left-handed men. You believe that?"
We're talking this is mean lifespan?
Left-handed men die typically at age, I think, 65.
Because they jerk off facing the North Pole, Bud said, in a remark that Richard could not analyze for one shred of content.
He watched Bud pry nails out of the old floorboards and offered to help, looking around for a claw hammer.
So, Richard?
What?
You drove 50 miles to tell me my phone's not working?
Richard didn't know if this was a setup for a scathing type of Bud Walling remark, or maybe just an ordinary thank you.
40 miles, Bud.
Well, that's a relief. I'd offer you a beer, but...
No problem.
Maybe it's Etna who drives 50 miles. I forget exactly.
It was not outside Bud's effective range to say something personal about his wife, maybe her sex preferences or digestive problems. And whenever he mentioned her name, old Richard caught his breath, hoping and fearing something intimate was coming. And even though he knew Bud did this to shock and repel him, Richard absorbed every word and image and smell description, watching Bud's long, creased face for signs of mockery.
She'll be sorry she missed you, Bud said, looking up from the wood rot and hanging dust.
He was not left-handed, but taught himself to shoot with the left hand. This is what Bud would never understand. How he had to take his feelings outside himself, so as to escape his isolation. He taught himself, based on the theory that if you are driving with your right hand and sitting snug to the door... It is better, practically speaking, to keep the right hand on the wheel and project the left hand out the window. The gun hand. So you don't have to fire across your body. He could probably talk to Bud about this, and Bud might understand. But he would never understand how Richard had to take everything outside, share it with others, become part of the history of others. Because this was the only way to escape. To get out from under the pissant details of who he was.
Bud was saying. So, cop says, feet together, head back, eyes shut, please. Which Etna starts to laugh when he says, please. Now spread your arms wide, he says. Now bring your left hand around and touch your nose with your index finger. Which I'm standing there in sheets of rain, and he's advising from the car. Touch your nose with your index finger, he tells me.
You're a left-hander driving a car, you're 5 times likely to die in a crash.
Then a right-hander.
Then a right-hander,
Richard said, religiously convinced. Bud ripped a board out of the floor.
Not my problem.
Mine neither.
I die from stress, Bud said. I'll tell you where my stress level's at.
Richard waited for the rest. He used to sit in a glass booth at the supermarket, batching personal checks and redeemed coupons and giving out rolled nickels to the checkout personnel. But he seemingly messed up somehow and was out at the counters again, running items over the scanner, keying fruit and vegetables into the register, subject to the casual abuse of passing strangers in the world.
We have to do our business outside because the toilet's not ready for human habitation. So I built a thing outside where this is the only workable method, pending I figure out the toilet. And Etna, well, you can imagine.
Coming home from work?
The stress builds up real personal.
Driving that drive?
Richard said. And she has to go. And then she remembers there's no working toilet in the house. And she looks at me, outright murderous.
They said unbelievable things. Obese women in the express line. With him having 2 sick parents at home. Or 1 sick and 1 bad-tempered. Like that 16 cents off the tomato paste. Oh, that's not a red pear, that's an Anjou. They forced him to ask across the aisle. Can't you see it's not red? He charged me for red. This here's an Anjou.
He had to speak across the aisle to the other checkout, where any person on either line could hear what he said.
For myself, I don't mind, Bud said, because it makes a certain amount of sense to take your business outside. When you think about what's involved...
They talk about head trauma. They talk about, is he adopted or was he abused? The problem is all in the spacing. If you fire out the window on the driver's side, which you have to do if you don't want to shoot across the width of your own car and the space between your car and the other car, you still face the problem of having to fire across the space between cars and the width of the other car, because the other driver's side is the far side in relation to your position at the wheel.
You're not going to shoot a passenger. If you shoot a passenger, then the driver is liable to take evasive action and note your license number and make a car and color of hair and so on. So you're going to shoot lone drivers, and you're going to fire out the window on your side, using the left hand to hold the weapon. But the fact is, as he eventually figured out, that if you shoot with the right hand, the natural hand, your projectile travels the same distance across the same spaces, pretty much, as the self-taught method of the left hand. He figured this out after victim 5 or 6, he forgets which, but decided to stick with the left hand as the shooting hand, even though it made more sense to steer with the left hand and shoot with the right, because the right hand was the born hand.
I just noticed what it was I couldn't figure out, Bud said.
They heard the dog barking, and Richard looked through the dusty sheeting and saw the animal thrust up on hind legs at the end of its chain, dog balls taut, and he hoped it might be Etna come home early. Etna made a pie for them once that had a latticed crust. This was something he remembered. Seeing it wasn't her coming home, but likely some critter in the woods that roused the dog, he felt a sadness out of all proportion. But then, everything was out of all proportion. The wind beat at the sheeting, making it shiver and pop. Crack cocaine is supposedly the cravingest form of substance abuse, according to studies made over time.
You're wearing a tie, Bud said.
Richard paused, wary about how to take this, peering inwardly ahead for a setup, a possible remark.
Well, that's from work, he said. I went home from work and didn't change.
But you wear ties? To check out groceries?
It's a company regulation. Statewide, pretty much.
Be calm, he thought.
And there's the thing Etna said, which she's right for a change, that you look like a guy that wears glasses. Except you don't. Except when she said it, we weren't sure. We said, does he or doesn't he?
Never did,
Richard said. When he first walked in the house and Bud barely noticed him, it was like the normalcy of dying. It was the empty, hollow thing of not being here. A 40-mile drive into being transparent. Awful, but not unaccustomed. But now this scrutiny as to what he wears and what he looks like. A panic set in. He tried to think of what to say. There might be something he could say about the dog. He searched for a glimpse of the dog through the sheeting. How nothing gets dirtier than plastic sheeting, retaining, absorbing the dirt.
Well, maybe you should. Glasses give appearance to a person. Get yourself some thick, dark frames that match your tie.
He didn't know why Bud would want to talk to him this way. Bud sat cross-legged over the narrow rent in the floor. He held the hammer at rest on his shoulder and looked directly into Richard's face. Richard tried to smile, make the whole thing humorous. He felt the stupidity of the look on his face, as if a turn of the mouth can alter the outside world.
I can think about it.
You do that.
I should probably be getting back.
She'll be sorry she missed you.
Tell her I said...
I'll be sure and do that.
The only person he ever talked to from the heart was Sue Ann. She made him feel real, talking on the phone. She gave him the feeling he was taking shape as himself, coming into the shape he'd always been intended to take, the thing of who he really was. It was like filling out. Did you ever feel things pouring out from the center of who you are and taking the shape of the intended person? Well, that's what Sue Ann did. And you can disbelieve it or disrespect it, but he was never really who he was until he talked to her. He heard Bud ripping up wood as he walked out the door to his car. With mental killers roaming the earth, the checkout boys wear neckties. That's what he thought Bud might say. He made the call to Sue Ann from a house he broke and entered, switched on the TV and called the superstation in Atlanta, and touched things with a hanky, and placed the voice device on the phone that he'd ordered from the back pages of a mercenary magazine. This was not a publication Richard normally perused. He was not a surveillance man or gun lover. His gun was his father's old .38. It did not have massive knockdown power, and it didn't shoot through concrete blocks or make fist-sized holes in silhouette targets. It just killed people. He drove out of the wooded area and into the open sky, where the road dropped down to the floodplain, and he felt the true force of the wind. He made the call and turned on the TV, or vice versa, without the sound. His hand wound in a doubled hanky. And he never felt so easy talking to someone on the phone, or face to face, or man to woman, as he felt that day talking to Sue Ann. He watched her over there, and talked to her over here. He saw her lips move silent in one part of the room, while her words fell soft and warm on the coils of his secret ear. He talked to her on the phone and made eye contact with the TV. This was the waking of the knowledge that he was real. This alien-eyed woman, with raving hair, sending emanations that astonished his heart. He spoke more confidently as time went on. He was coming into himself, shy, but also unashamed, a little vain, even, and honest and clever, evasive when he needed to be. Standing there in a stranger's house near a lamp without a shade, and she listened and asked questions, watching him from the screen 10 feet away. She had so much radiance, she could make him real. This was an untraveled road. Travel 30 miles on this road and you may not see another car. You see power lines extended to the limits of vision, sinking toward the earth as a matter of perspective. When the wind dies, there's a suspense that falls across the land and makes you think about the hush before the judgment. Then they cut away to the tape. He was suspicious of the tape, because it had a vista different from his experience. And he kept thinking the girl was going to move the camera and get him in the picture. He'd watched the tape a dozen times, sitting with his pain-racked dad, and every time he watched the tape, he thought he was going to turn up in his own living room, detached from who he was, peering squint-eyed over the wheel of his compact car. He called Sue Ann twice after that, but the switchboard wouldn't put him through because many others were trying to reach her now, and the switchboard was leery and abrupt and unbelieving. He needed her to keep him whole. He probably would have told her his name. She would have broken him down completely over a number of calls, over a number of days, watching him from the screen. He would have surrendered to her in a blaze of lights. Richard Henry Gilkey, hustled down a hallway with Stetsoned men all around him, and Sue Ann Corcoran by his side. He drove past the flagpole with the banging halyard. The wind was banging the halyard against the pole, and it made him weak somehow. The repeated meaning of this noise. He went in the house and saw his dad twisted whole in front of the TV set. Mother was in the kitchen running a beater inside a white bowl.
"Look what got dragged in by the scruff. I went out to Bud's. Do we have time for you to go out to Bud's? We need to give Daddy his nitrous band."
"Well, go ahead and do it."
"Well, aren't we supposed to call about the new dosage?"
"I didn't call. Did you call?" she said.
The glass booth had a talk hole
where you talked. But they sent him out to the checkout and forced him to talk across the aisle.
I'll call, she said, but he's not there.
You get the answering service.
I'll get the answering service, and they'll tell me he's not there.
I meant to call, he said.
I'll call, she said, and you do the ointment.
After dinner, he did the ointment on his father's chest. His father lay back on the bed with the stubbled look of an old man turning into a castaway, a reject of the islands. Except for his eyes, they were moist and deep, pleading for time. Richard spread the ointment and buttoned his father's pajama tops, and he thought about the time, any day now, when he would have to wipe his behind. Pending notification of next of kin. He came alive in them. He lived in their histories, in the photographs in the newspaper. He survived in the memories of the family, lived with the victims, lived on, merged, twinned, quadrupled, continued into double figures. He stood at the kitchen door watching her stir some solution for his father's first intake of the next day.
Well, you have good night now.
You sleep well, she said.
He went to his room and sat in a chair to take off his shoes. All the meaning of a given life was located in the act of leaning over to untie your shoes and set them in a designated place for the start of the following day. He thought about the other person. When he was stationed on the booth, he had the talk hole to talk through. But when they put him back at the checkout, he had to talk in the open space where anyone could hear. He kept the gun hidden in the car. And he thought about this as he drifted near sleep. And he thought about the other person who'd shot a driver on one of the highways where he had shot a driver just one day later. The so-called copycat shooting. He didn't like to think about this, but found it was lately more and more a taunting presence in his mind. He was an early riser. He heard the rain on the roof, and he dressed and ate a muffin standing up, a hand cupped under his chin to catch the crumbs. He had 3.5 hours before it was time to report to work. He heard the rain dripping off the eaves and hitting the pie tin where he left food for a stray cat when he remembered.
I know who I am. Who is he?
He zipped up his jacket. Then he put the glove on his left hand, a woman's white glove, and he went out to the empty street, where his car sat waiting under the sheet metal sky. Part 3. The Cloud of Unknowing, Spring, 1978. Chapter 1. I've always been a country of one. There's a certain distance in my makeup, a measured separation, like my old man's, I guess, that I've worked at times to reduce, or thought of working, or said the hell with it. I like to tell my wife, I say to my wife, I tell her not to give up on me. I tell her there's an Italian word, or a Latin word, that explains everything. Then I tell her the word. She says, what does this explain? And she answers, nothing. The word that explains nothing in this case is lontananza. Distance or remoteness, sure. But as I use the word, as I interpret it, hard-edged and fine-grained, it's the perfected distance of the gangster, the syndicate mobster, the made man. Once you're a made man, you don't need the constant living influence of sources outside yourself. You're all there. You're made. You're handmade. You're a sturdy Roman wall.
I was in Los Angeles thinking about these things. People say L.A. is only half there. And maybe that's why I was thinking about my father. And also because my brother Matt. It was Matt's endless premise, his song of songs, that our old man Jimmy was living somewhere in Southern California under the usual assumed name. I told him Jimmy was dead under his own name. We were the ones with assumed names. But the curious thing, the contradiction, is that I was standing in the middle of a fenced enclosure in a bungalow slum, looking up at the spires of the great strange architectural cluster known as the Watts Towers. An idiosyncrasy out of someone's innocent anarchistic visions. And the more I looked, the more I thought of Jimmy. The towers and birdbaths and fountains and decorated posts and bright oddments and household colors, the green of 7-Up bottles and blue of milk of magnesia, all the vivid tile embedded in cement, the whole complex of structures and gates and panels that were built, hand-built, by one man, alone, an immigrant from somewhere near Naples, probably illiterate, who left his wife and family, or maybe they left him, I wasn't sure, a man whose narrative is mostly blank spaces, date of birth uncertain, until he ends up spending 33 years building this thing out of steel rods and broken crockery and pebbles and seashells and soda bottles and wire mesh, all hand-mortared, 3,000 sacks of sand and cement. And who spends these years with glass specks crusting his hands and arms, and glass dust in his eyes as he hangs from a window washer's belt high on the towers, in torn overalls and a dusty fedora, face burnt brown with lights strung on the radial spokes so he could work at night, maybe 90 feet up, and Caruso on the gramophone below? Jimmy was an edge-seeker, a palmist, inferring the future out of his own lined flesh. But he looked at his hand one day, according to my little brother, and it was blank. And did he become... could I imagine him as a runaway eccentric? In a way, yes. A man who doesn't wash or change his clothes, bummy-looking, talks to himself on the street. And in another way, maybe I could imagine him rising this high, soaring out of himself to produce a rambling art that has no category, with cement and chicken wire. This was the contradiction. Jimmy's future closed down the night he went out for cigarettes. Why would I even try to imagine him in an alternative reality, coming out here, half here, escaping to the Angelino light, the Mediterranean weather? I walked among the openwork towers, 3 tall, 4 smaller ones, and saw the Delftware he'd plastered under a canopy, and the molten glass and mother-of-pearl he'd pressed into adobe surfaces. Whatever the cast-off nature of the materials, the seeming off-handedness and whatever the dominance of pure intuition, the man was surely a master builder. There was a structural unity to the place, a sense of repeated themes and deft engineering. And his initials here and there, S.R., Sabato Rodia, if this was in fact his correct name, S.R. carved in archways, like the gang graffiti in the streets outside. I tried to understand the force of Jimmy's presence here. I saw him shabby and muttering, but also unconstrained, with nothing and no one to answer to, in a shoebox room somewhere, slicing a pear with a penknife. Jimmy alive. And then I thought of a thing that happened when I was about 8 years old. And it was a memory that clarified the connections. I saw my father standing across the street watching 2 young men, greenhorns, trying to lay brick for a couple of gateposts in front of someone's modest house. First he watched, then he advised, gesturing, speaking a studied broken English that the young men might grasp. And then he moved decisively in, handing his jacket to someone and redirecting the length of string and taking the trowel and setting the bricks in courses and leveling the grout, working quickly. And I didn't know he could do this kind of work. and I don't think my mother knew it either. I went across the street and felt a shy kind of pride, surrounded by middle-aged men and older, the fresh air inspectors, they were called. And you've never seen happier people, watching a man in a white shirt and tie do a skillful brickwork bond. When he finished the towers, Sabato Rodia gave away the land and all the art that was on it. He left Watts and went away, he said, to die. The work he did is a kind of swirling, free-souled noise, a jazz cathedral. And the power of the thing for me, the deep disturbance, was that my own ghost father was living in the walls. The waitress brought a chilled fork for my lifestyle salad. Big Sims was eating a cheeseburger with three kinds of cheddar, each described in detail on the menu. There was a crack in the wall from the tremor of the day before, and when Sims laughed, I saw his mouth cat's-cradled with filaments of gleaming cheese. We heard the test flights shrieking out of Edwards. Sims said they had aircraft that bounced off the edge of space and came back, born again. We were at Mojave Springs, a conference center some distance from Los Angeles. I'd recently gone to work for Waste Containment, known in the industry as WhizCo, and I was here in the spirit of freshman orientation, to adjust to the language and customs, and my unofficial advisor was Simeon Biggs, a landfill engineer who'd been with the firm for 4 or 5 years. There were a number of waste-handling firms represented at the Springs, and we were sharing seminar space with a smaller and more committed group, 40 married couples, who were here to trade sexual partners and talk about their feelings. We were the waste managers, they were the swingers, and they made us feel self-conscious. Sim said, "The ship's been out there sailing port to port. It's almost 2 years now." "And what, they won't accept the cargo?"
"Country after country."
"How toxic is the cargo?"
"I hear rumors," he said. "This isn't my area, of course. Happens in some back room in a New York office. It's a folk tale about a spectral ship, the Flying Liberian."
"I thought terrible substances were dumped routinely in LDCs." An LDC, I just found out, was a less developed country in the language of banks and other global entities.
"Those little dark-skinned countries. Yes, it's a nasty business that's getting bigger all the time. A country will take a fee amounting to 4 times its gross national product to accept a shipment of toxic waste. What happens after that? We don't want to know."
"All right. But what makes this cargo unacceptable? And why don't we know what the shipment actually consists of?"
"Maybe we're trying to spare ourselves a certain amount of embarrassment," Sim said.
The tremor had hit at cocktail time, when I was standing in the hospitality suite with a number of colleagues who peered over their drinks in the slow lean of the world. The room whistled and groaned. I worked at controlling the look on my face, waiting for the situation to define itself. It wasn't a mild shock. It was in the middle fives, we later learned, a 5.4, and I felt justified in my sense of potential alarm, seeing the crack in the restaurant wall when we sat down to lunch. "You think what? It's a drug shipment? Disguised as toxic waste? Because I hear rumors, too."
"Tell me about it," Sim said.
He sat across the table, meat face and wide body, the jut underlip, the odd little unlobed ears, round and perfectly worked, the tiny mannered ears of a sprite child.
"I'm eager to hear your version," he said,
a trace of sweet condescension in his voice. "One, it's a heroin shipment, which makes no sense. 2, it's incinerator ash from the New York area. Industrial grade, mainly. 20 million pounds. Arsenic, copper, lead, mercury."
"Dioxins,"
Smith said agreeably, biting into the middle of his mesquite-grilled beef.
Four couples took the round table nearby, and Sims and I observed a pause. We wanted to be amused and slightly derisive. These were swingers, of course, dressed assertively in the third person, and they leaned back in sequence when the boy poured water.
"They take time out for lunch. I respect that," Sims said.
"I hear things about the ship."
"The ship keeps changing names. You hear that?"
"No, I don't."
"The ship left a pier on the Hudson River with one name. I don't know what it was, but it got changed 3 months later off the West African coast. Then they changed it again. This was somewhere in the Philippines."
"Enormous quantities of heroin, I hear."
"But why would heroin get shipped from the U.S. to the Far East? Makes no sense."
"Makes no sense," Sims said. "Except it ties in with another rumor. You know this rumor?"
"I don't think so."
"Mob-owned."
He liked saying this. He rounded out the words, popped his eyes a little.
"What's mob-owned?"
"The company that owns the ships we lease. The mob has a lot of involvement in waste carting. So why not waste handling, waste shipment, waste everything?"
"There's a word in Italian," I said.
"Maybe it's not just the shipping company. Maybe it's our company. We're mob-owned. They're a silent partner. Well, they own us outright."
He liked saying this even more. Not that he believed it.
He didn't believe it for half a second, but he wanted me to believe it, or entertain the thought so he could ridicule me.
He had a hard grin that mocked whatever facile sentiments you might be tempted to shelter in the name of your personal conspiracy credo.
"There's a word in Italian, dietrologia.
It means the science of what is behind something, a suspicious event, the science of what is behind an event."
"They need this science. I don't need it."
"I don't need it either. I'm just telling you."
"I'm an American. I go to ball games," he said.
"The science of dark forces. Evidently, they feel this science is legitimate enough to require a name."
"People who need this science? I would make an effort to tell them we have real sciences, hard sciences. We don't need imaginary ones."
"I'm just telling you the word. I agree with you, Sims, but the word exists."
"There's always a word. There's probably a museum, too. The Museum of Dark Forces. They have 10,000 blurry photographs. Or did the Mafia blow it up?"
This is where Sims laughed, showing a mouth crisscrossed with cheddar. I checked the round table. Two of the women smoked. Two of the women wore studded Western vests. One was nearsighted, sticking her head in the menu, and one had an accent I couldn't place. All the women were ornamented, decked in chains, bracelets, and breastpins, in hoop earrings with bead pendants, jewelry with a hammered look, a pounded look, and one chewed a carrot stick and talked about her kids.
"You know Italian?" he said.
"I studied Latin for a while, in school, then on my own, pretty intensively, and dabbled in German and Italian."
"My wife is German," he said. "Met her when I was stationed there."
"A GI with a swagger?"
"That pretty much says it. Except I was Air Force."
"She speaks German around the house?"
"A little bit. Yeah, quite a lot."
"You understand?"
"I better understand," he said.
The men wore broad-collared print shirts, unbuttoned to the thorax. The men were all hair. Not the protest hair of the 60s, of course. Chest hair, mustaches, brushy sideburns, great heads of Hollywood hair. Real hair that resembled toupees in bad taste. Wish-fulfilling rug tops, sort of spit-curled and heavily surfed. Big Sims called for the check.
"But we like our jobs, don't we, Nick? Whoever owns the ships we use."
"I like my job."
"I like my job."
His sport coat was draped over the back of his chair,
too broad to fit snugly over the palmettes that adorned the top rail. He wore a white short-sleeved shirt with a dark tie and a tie clip shaped like a scimitar. He gave me a tight-eyed look. "Want to go to a Dodger game?"
"No,"
I said. It didn't seem surprising, all these ghost ship stories, even if they were only elusive hearsay, because we'd been told the night before that waste is the best-kept secret in the world. This is what Jesse Detweiler said, the garbage archaeologist who'd addressed the masked members about an hour after the tremor. An address that did not go down well with the grilled squab and baby Zen vegetables. Our faces showed a pristine alertness back there at cocktail time when the room shook around us. It was a look that trailed a self-awareness in its wake, a sheepish sense of our own glimpsed fear, of being caught unaware just before we gained control. And this is the face that traveled through the suite, above the vodka tonics, creating an ironic bond among the managers in the indoor wind. We saw Detweiler in the lobby after we paid the bill. Sims went over and collared him, literally. Got him in a headlock and mock-pummeled his shaved dome. They were acquaintances, it seemed, and the three of us made a date to drive out to a landfill that Sims had designed, a massive project still in development. A man and woman walked across the lobby, and I watched her carefully. Maybe it was the hip-sprung way she moved, high-assed and shiny, alert to surfaces, like a character in a B-movie soaked in alimony and gin. I went over and checked the schedule of events on the easeled board near the revolving doors, registration and coffee, licensing laws, spent fuel storage, all the topics and speakers in movable white type, 10 to 12 and 2 to 5 and on into the night. And I thought about the swingers and their arrangements. Whizco was a firm with an inside track to the future of waste. This was the name we gave our conference in the desert. The meeting was industry-wide, but we were the firm that provided the motive force. We were the front-runners, the go-getters, the guys who were ready to understand the true dimensions of the subject. I was in my early 40s, hired away from a thin-blooded job as a corporate speechwriter and public relations aide, and I was ready for something new, for a faith to embrace. Corporations are great and appalling things. They take you and shape you in nearly nothing flat, twist and swivel you. And they do it without overt persuasion. They do it with smiles and nods, a collective inflection of the voice. You stand at the head of a corridor, and by the time you walk to the far end, you have adopted the comprehensive philosophy of the firm. The Weltanschauung. I use this grave and layered word because somewhere in its depths there is a whisper of mystical contemplation that seems totally appropriate to the subject of waste.
This ends Disc 9.